Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
We're currently doing research on two of the more critical fiber quality properties in our Fiber of the Future program.
Vicki Martin with Cotton Incorporated.
We're focused on improving length uniformity measurements for cotton breeders, and we're working on fiber fineness. The reason that again, we're focused on length uniformity and also on fiber fineness is that both of these play a critical role in yarn processing. They can play a very critical role in the size yarn that we want to produce. And we are trying to make cotton more competitive against the rayons and the polyesters out there and move us into market categories. And one way that we can do that is if we can fine tune our uniformity and our fineness, we have a greater opportunity for greater market potential.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
We always try and squeeze in some new questions to see what people are thinking about. And this was a time of year when people are starting to think about whether or not they're going to plant a cover crop this fall. So we thought it'd be timely to ask people about cover crops on their farm operations. So we included a few questions on that topic.
Purdue University economist and director of the Center for Commercial Agriculture, Dr. Jim Mentert.
And the first one was, have you ever planted a cover crop on your operation? And the part of that that we like to kind of focus on is the group that says, yes, and I currently plant cover crops. This month, that was 45% of the crop operators in the survey. So for clarification, this question went to people who grow corn, soybeans, wheat, or cotton. If they don't grow one of those crops, they didn't get this question. 45% said yes currently. The last time we asked this question, which was back in September of last year, 57%. We asked it in September of 21, it was 52%, and we asked it in August of 21, it was 41%. And I actually think what we've got going on there, Michael, is probably some sampling variability, don't you? Yeah, and that's also consistent with what we've observed on some of the farms, not all the farms, but some of the farms on the farm management tour. Not unusual for people to target specific aspects of the farm operation for cover crops. Some cases it's experimental, right, trying to learn about it a little bit. In some cases they literally have some farms that they think belong in cover crops, and so they target that way. So good point there. We also followed up then and asked those folks that said they plant cover crops, what are your motivations for planting cover crops? And they have, I think we had six buckets or maybe five buckets that they could choose from. The buckets were improve soil health, improve erosion control, improve water quality, carbon sequestration, and then the other category. So that could be almost anything. But, you know, no big surprise. 35% said soil health was their number one reason or one of their top reasons. Improve erosion control was also chosen by, I think, 30%. So those two are the top two. Improve water quality. Again, we've asked this question now four times. Very consistent, right around 20%. This month it was 19%, so it was about water quality. Probably the most interesting thing on this response category is the percentage that chose carbon sequestration. This month, 10% of the people who said they plant cover crops said that one of the reasons, not the only reason, but one of the reasons is carbon sequestration. That struck both of us as surprisingly high. Although it's consistent, we've got, of the four times we've asked this question, three times it's been at 10 or 11%. One time it was at 5%.
And the reason for that is that's higher than the percentage of people that have engaged in carbon contracts. That's why we're thinking that. Because usually if you're engaged in carbon contracts, you're going to sign a carbon contract, carbon sequestration is a big issue. But if you're not, it's usually not as big an issue.
Yeah, and let me elaborate on that. The way most of the carbon contracts work is if you've already been using carbon cover crops, you have trouble latching onto a new contract. And so the responses to this question sort of imply that there's a little bit more going on with respect to signing carbon contracts than maybe we're picking up in some of our other survey questions. So, but I think it's interesting. Three out of four times we've got a response in that 10 to 11% category. And I guess the other thing, Michael, there's always a little bit of ambiguity in terms of how people interpret the question. Some of these folks might be thinking about signing a carbon contract and a possible motivation for planting cover crops. Maybe they haven't actually done it.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
We had basically flat, you know, kind of a boring week there, which is consistent with the fed cattle story here.
Kansas State livestock economist Dr. Glenn Tonser looking at box beef cutouts.
Choice closed the week at 302, was off about a dollar from the week before, and Select was at 278, up about a dollar. No major action there as well. This is usually where I interject. You know, it was a fairly calm week overall. And, you know, probably for at least 3 years now, we've had lots of uncalm weeks, right? Lots of surprises, excitement, whatever. But I actually think it's healthy for markets to be calm and boring, establish a footing and so forth. And I interject that because the majority of the numbers I shared here were small changes, that's still a healthy thing for markets.
And what's this mean for feedlot returns?
I update these once a month, take production type info from the Animal Science and Industry Department and marry it up with, you know, Kansas fed cattle, feeder cattle, and corn prices. These were last updated July 7th, and I've been on the road, so we're here late getting these to folks. But actually, the live cattle market's been flatter up since then, and corn's up just a little bit, but less so. So these returns are probably even a little bit better today than the numbers I'm going to share. But regardless, the projected returns for steers leaving Kansas yards, if you have not hedged them, so if you're in just like a totally exposed cash market situation, are $150 or more per steer between now and Christmas. So specifically, steers leaving the yard in December are projected to have a positive return of $159 per head. The high water mark is actually in November, is 261, October is 256. There's multiple months in here of over $200 positive returns. What that reflects on balance is the fed cattle market has strengthened since those cattle were placed. So they would have been placed, you know, 5 to 7 months earlier at lighter weights. And there's been some ongoing improvement in the cost of gain. Admittedly, the last couple of weeks, corn's went up, but overall, corn is cheaper and more generally, cost of gain is lower. So both sides of that profit margin have improved since the cattle were placed. Once we get into 2024, things look a little bit different. We're projecting small losses, and the volume going through feed yards is probably going to continue to shrink. So utilization of your feed yard is a bigger deal. But for the next 6 months, it does look, you know, cattle that are in the yard today are in a pretty nice spot.
Tonser also heads up something known as the meat demand monitor.
Here at K-State, we've maintained multiple meat demand measures, some of which are more recent and survey-based, and that is the meat demand monitor, and others are more USDA, a little bit more backward-looking, historical-based, and when those are updated varies. So the meat demand monitor, which is the resource that's beef and pork checkoff supported, is, you know, ongoing. We collect data every day, as I said, national survey-based. The July data collection just ended, and by the time this week is over, I anticipate the July report will be posted to Ag Manager. What is available there is a little bit more dated USDA-based demand indices. So we take USDA data and we track both for domestic and foreign demand of U.S. beef, pork, and chicken. And the latest numbers there are for the month of May, and this is where I comment about the time lag. Some of that data comes in later, particularly the trade data, when we know what we exported and imported is a little slower to come in. But in May of 23, the all fresh beef, the pork, and the chicken demand indices for domestic consumers were all up from April, which is great. Comparing May of 23, beef and pork demand was actually down versus May of 22. So put a bow on that. Year-over-year demand decline, but a little bit of improvement compared to April domestically. And then we flip over to foreign demand, which we don't always talk as much about, but foreign consumer demand for U.S. meat products is increasingly important over time. Again, May demand for beef, pork, and chicken by foreign consumers was up versus April. However, beef and chicken were down versus May, and pork is up almost 25%, but that's from a smaller base. And when we look back at May of 22, export demand for pork was pretty low, and there's been a bit of a renaissance in the last few months. So to summarize that again for your listeners, the May data looked good compared to April domestically, as well as on the foreign front, and look for in the days ahead the updated July look from the Meat Demand Monitor.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
The hard to decarbonize areas like airlines, like industrial, like trucking require something different. We're not going to probably in anytime soon be able to electrify, for example, airplanes. So we've got to have them run on sustainable fuels.
Secretary of Energy Jennifer Granholm.
And there's going to be a 40% increase in the demand for that fuel for airlines before 2050. So we've got to get cracking on making sure that they're running on fuels that are sustainable. And that means that having a sustainable aviation fuel supply is going to be massive. So the global airline industry this week announced a commitment to 100% sustainable aviation fuels by 2050. In the United States, we have done that as well, and that means for the U.S. fleet alone, it's going to be 35 billion gallons every year that is necessary to create that sustainable aviation fuel. We've also committed, we've had our own sustainable aviation fuel grand challenge, $3 billion gallons that we want to have annually by 2030. Billion. So we're going to need a lot of new refineries to be able to meet that goal, about 200 new refineries, and we're going to be able to bolt on equipment to the existing refineries if they choose to do this, to be able to supply that fuel. We want to make sure that there's support for that in the reconciliation bill that's currently before Congress, and there is. So the pieces are all coming together to be able to include and have the ag community lead, the rural community of our country lead in producing the sustainable aviation fuel, or SAF as we call it.
She also talks about solar.
And what we want to do is incentivize the manufacturing and the deployment of solar across our country to help our energy mix be clean. In the same way, of course, that we've seen wind be really taken up very robustly by the ag community, we want to have solar be a part of that mix as well. So we want to be able to not just install panels that are manufactured elsewhere, like in China. We want to make them here. We want to make the racks here. We want to make sure that we incentivize and pay for the production here so that our ag community and the rest of the country can also benefit from that. We're announcing today a big community solar goal, which is that we want to power another 5 million homes with community solar by 2025. So lots of big goals. And now we've only got to move toward them.
But again, very excited about the sustainable fuel sector.
We were just at this LanzaTech this morning, which is a company that does the sustainable aviation fuels. And the technology that they're using is so interesting. They take ethanol and they need some carbon. They need other pollutants. They take waste. And they put it into a process that's a biological process, and out comes fuel that is sustainable. So the notion of what's going on technology-wise and how biologic processes are being used to convert waste into fuel is really exciting. You can do it with the municipal solid waste. You can do it certainly with the waste from forests and trees, and you can do it with the offtake from carbon out of just regular ethanol production. So it's, to me, that kind of waste to energy, waste to sustainable energy is very exciting. And that's part of my crystal ball.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
Each month we survey 400 farmers across the U.S. to learn more about their perspectives on the ag economy. This month's Ag Barometer survey was conducted from the 10th through the 14th of July.
Dr. Jim Mentert is director of the Center for Commercial Agriculture at Purdue.
The Ag Economy Barometer rose slightly. I mean, it's a very small change. The reading this month was 123. That's up from 121 last month. And, of course, last month we did have a big jump or a big improvement in the barometer, so I don't want to discount that. That does leave the barometer about 20 points higher than it was this time last year. But still below where it was a couple years ago. You go back 2 years ago, that index was at 134. Last year at this time, it was a 103. This month's reading, 123.
So why the change?
When I was doing the write-up this month, the first thing I looked at was the change in commodity prices that occurred from when we conducted the survey in mid-June to when we conducted the survey in mid-July. And I used the Wednesday settlement prices on the futures prices to look at that, and looked at cash prices as well in terms of like fall bids, for example. And I think fall bids for corn delivery between mid-June to mid-July fell about 13%. But soybean bids and wheat bids for a new crop were both up. I think they were both up in the range of about 7 to 8%. So it was kind of a mixed bag, and I think that's exactly the way farmers looked at it, right? So on one hand, you know, from a corn revenue standpoint, things looked weaker than they did in mid-June. but that was at least partially counterbalanced by what was going on with some of the other commodities. And I think that's probably why we wound up with an index that was pretty close to what it was a month earlier.
Part of the survey gives an index of current conditions and future expectations.
The current condition index was the driver of that small increase that we saw in the barometer. It was up 5 points compared to last month. It also leaves that index, I think, 11% higher than it was in July of 22. The future expectation index was up just 1 point, so almost no change at all. But that index is, I think, 24% higher than it was a year ago. So, you know, if you look at a chart of those two, they're basically sitting on top of one another, right? So that future expectation index is 124, the concurrent condition index is 121. They're really just laying right on top of each other. So it's kind of unusual that we see that take place, right? Normally we have people a little more optimistic about the future or a little more optimistic about the current situation. They're both feeling about the same on both.
There's also a financial performance index.
Financial performance index was up 1 point, so again, almost no change. That reading is 87 versus 86 last month. A couple of months ago, back in May, that index was at 76, so things do look stronger there than they did back in May. If you compare it to 2 years ago, or compared to last year, it was 1 point lower than a year ago, and then 12 points below where it was 2 years ago. And that's no big surprise given what was going on in 2021.
And what about financial expectations?
So it's interesting to look at some of the sub-questions, the questions that we use to derive the indices. And so this one is kind of interesting. Do you expect your farm's financial performance to be better than, worse than, or about the same as last year? And we saw a change, not so much between July and June, but really maybe going back to May. There's been an improvement in the percentage of people who think that their farm's going to have better financial performance than last year. Back in May, that was 14%. This month, it's 17%. On the other side of that coin, only 30% say that financial performance is going to be worse this year than last year. Again, you go back to May, that was 38%.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
We just updated a calf vaccination program assessment tool.
Kansas State beef economist, Dr. Glenn Tonser.
It's an Excel resource for those that are trying to decide whether to enroll your calves, whether it's this year's crop or thinking ahead even for next year's crop, into the VAC 45, VAC 60, pre-con, those kind of additional weaning and, you know, vaccination programs versus sellout weaning or maybe an alternative vaccination program. That tool was built in partnership with Merck Animal Health. It's informed by beefbasis.com and some work we've done with Superior Livestock Auction data. So there's a lot of info I just threw at you, but the punchline is that Excel tool is used to help you make a hopefully more informed decision whether it's worth it to have the additional expense and the foregone sale of your calves to a later date at a heavier weight by enrolling them in a vaccination, you know, based program. We've updated that, and I would make use of that as well.
So what could be ahead?
We have both the January and the July cattle inventory report. USDA NAS, which is the statistics service of ag here in the U.S., does the head counting, in this case for cattle, twice a year. And it gives us a look at the size of the herd, you know, how many heifers are being held back and the like. And forgive me, I haven't listened to what Lee said, but I will just summarize broader and then give some Kansas comments here. But big picture, you know, we confirmed what we thought, right? The herd continues to shrink, have yet to pull the trigger on at least national expansion. And in states like Kansas, that is certainly true. Mother Nature is the primary reason the herd is smaller, not, you know, market signals themselves. So feeder cattle prices and the upcoming couple of years look to be very attractive for those that can sustain their cow herds. But on balance, Mother Nature hasn't allowed the rebuild and the subsequent expansion. I don't know if Lee said this, but I always interject this, is A, I know he probably didn't plug. We have an Excel tool on our, again, Ag Manager that is called KSU Beef Replacement. So if you're in the spot where you're thinking about expanding your herd, that tool quantifies the net present value. So you could use that and update it with some of the information that was in that mid-cattle year report. But I also interject here, there's a lot of topic about whether we're expanding the national herd or not. I think it's healthy to break it down into a rebuild where I was versus a net expansion. An example I would use is if I'm a Kansas cow-calf operator and say in normal times I have 100 cows, but today I find myself running with maybe 80. So for whatever reason, the last 2 or 3 years, I've shrunk, you know, probably as part of my forage management strategy. The economics to get back to 100 are not only looking at the current feeder cattle market and them being attractive as my main sales price and main revenue source, but also if I add 20 more cows back, I have a 25% increase in my herd that I'm spreading my fixed cost across. So if I have the same land base, the same labor, the same, you know, John Deere tractor, whatever, you know, kind of fairly fixed assets that I'm using in my operation. If I can get back to my previous steady state of 100, I'm spreading my, you know, next fixed cost over more head. And that alone, even if you have sort of normal feeder cattle prices, that alone's a pretty big driver. But if you are doing that and you have attractive feeder cattle prices, the carrot to, you know, rebuild and then potentially expand is even greater. I interject that because I am very confident that when Mother Nature allows us, a lot of operations that have had sort of a forced pull down in the last 2 or 3 years are going to be among those that rebuild as soon as they can, as long as they are in an equity position and their lender support it. So the last comment here would be, is the sooner you talk to your lender about that, the better. So borrowing rates have went up, so that's also the bait to sooner to go talk. But just more generally, you know, it takes more capital today to rebuild a herd than it did 5 years ago and certainly 25 years ago. And the sooner you can talk to your banker to line that up, the better you'll be.
He says if you want to know more,
go Ag Manager, and then, you know, across the top, there's lots of kind of drop-down menus. One of them is called Contributors, and that's a list of those of us that are a little more actively presenting information on Ag Manager, and they're in alphabetical order. So go down to Tonzer, or I usually joke, you know, look for the Bald Economist, you know, logo. You'll find me there. But if you click on Tonzer, you find reverse, you know, dated resources. These feedlot returns are monthly. These meat demand information is monthly and so forth. So you can find all that. So if this is helpful to you, please make use of that.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
There are many, many different players in the space of carbon markets. Here are just a few. NORI is one, Carbon Market Removal Marketplace. Soilwater Outcomes is another. We're actually working with them on a pilot project. Truterra, Indigo Ag. You've probably heard of a few of these. And you might have some questions, or, you know, you might question what their motives are, or does it make sense to engage with them?
Dr. Jesse Daystar is Chief Sustainability Officer at Cotton Incorporated.
So throughout this conversation here, I'm going to give you some questions and some things to think about that would help you be more informed as to how you might want to approach these folks, and if you should get into the game, if you will. So we hear a lot of questions such as these, such as, how do we overcome barriers of entry? You know, this verification, something called additionality, which I'll talk about. Financial barriers, you know, cover crops aren't free. How would a farmer be paid? Is it an upfront check? Is it after several years, or, you know, every year? Also, your data is valuable. How is that going to be protected? Is some input provider going to see that data and take value from that and charging more down the road? Things such as that are certainly important. Also, Gary mentioned, you know, what the kind of blank slate around regulation. How is this going to be regulated? Who makes the rules, and are those rules changing? How long are contracts? That certainly is a big one. And what happens if you break that contract? And, you know, I don't want any cotton grower to sign up to an unfair contract and be, you know, up in a bind later. And what is realistic to expect? And certainly trust is important. And who can you trust? So these are all things that you probably have running through your mind amongst many more.
He explains carbon offsets.
What a carbon offset is. So imagine, you see here, an airplane. Well, when you travel through the air, it certainly creates a significant amount of CO2. And while you can use some biofuels, for example, it's hard to put solar panels and to completely go to renewable energy on an airplane just because it has to be light and, you know, aerodynamic. Solar panels are not going to help that. So in reality, Delta or other airplanes are going to probably have CO2 emissions, but if they have reduction goals, they could potentially pay somebody to plant trees or implement renewable energy solutions such as solar or wind to offset some of their emissions. And they would pay those individuals or those businesses to do so. And then the businesses would give them a credit and some sort of certification to say that they have done an action that reduced impacts on climate change as a result of that a payment and initial system from the airline company. So it's sort of a system of where we can't reduce, we can actually capture, and it's somewhat of a wash in the end. And typically, this is measured on a ton of CO2 equivalents. So it includes such things as methane and nitrous oxide, but it's all related back to CO2, and that is a metric ton. So that's what you're buying when you say purchase a carbon credit, and that's roughly around $15, $20 today.
And how credits are created.
To make these carbon credits, there's two different ways. One is capture it. And you can actually, you know, capture carbon in the ground by using cover crops and reducing tillage, amongst other activities that actually store carbon in the ground. And storing it for long periods of time is what we're looking for. So carbon capture is one route towards creating a carbon credit. The second is reducing emissions. Here is just a pie chart that shows the emissions associated with Cotton production, I just call out fertilizer and field emissions, which is primary fertilizer and nitrous oxide. So you can actually say you could get rid of part of that field emissions by using cover crops or reducing your or be more efficient with your nitrogen. That reduction could potentially count as a carbon credit, and you might be able to get paid for certain activities that reduce your overall emissions at your field. So there's two different ways: carbon capture and reduction of emissions, or abatement is another term for that.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
USDA called the Pratt market $5 to $8 higher, depending on what weight class we might quote. Two of the larger head lots that I took note of, 117 head weighing 812 pounds, went for 246. 159 head came in at 958 pounds, went for 240. Both of those would be a solid $5 higher from the week before. We continue to have strength in the feeder cattle market would be the punchline of that.
Kansas State beef economist Dr. Glenn Tonser.
The volume is lower, as we've talked in other settings, but it is above. The reason I said this was mixed was fed cattle was more flat. So AMS called the five area fed cattle, really both Thursday and Friday last week, flat at 180. That's basically what it was the week before. When you look over to the board, CME Friday contracts closed. We have both August nearby for live and feeder cattle. Live cattle is 178, down about $2 for the week. And then feeder cattle was 246, about flat for the week. So more strength in the feeder cattle cash market than the other markets I was breaking down there.